Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Emily Berman of the Brennan Center for Justice, who challenges the right of President Obama to order the assassination of a U.S. citizen with alleged links to acts of terrorism without following minimum standards of due process. Environmental justice and green jobs advocate Van Jones, who talks about confronting the nation's environmental and economic crises with a new kind of thinking. And Craig Aaron, Senior Program Director with the media democracy group Free Press, who explains the importance of a recent federal court decision jeopardizing net neutrality for internet users and content providers. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human Rights Watch is investigating hundreds of cases of rights abuses against the Pakistan Army, including retaliatory killings during its sweep against the Taliban in the Swat Valley last September. According to the Washington Post, the investigation centres on 300 extrajudicial killings in Mingora, the Swat Valley's district capital. Ali Diane Hassan, South Asia analyst for Human Rights Watch, stated, "We can only assume it is part of the counter-terrorism effort by the security forces to shoot people in the back of the head." The Obama administration has been aware of these human rights allegations for months. Top US officials such as Secretary of Defense Robert Gates have discussed the issue with Pakistan's military leaders. Most US aid to Pakistan is reliant on a satisfactory human rights certification. The US government has provided Pakistan with $18 billion in combined military and development aid since 2002. President Obama has recently requested another $3 billion in aid for Pakistan. The Pakistani army has denied these allegations of extrajudicial killings. Facing an uprising over corruption charges and spiking utility rates, Kyrgyzstan's president, Kurmanbek Bakiyev, fled the capital city of Bishkek and lost control over his government. These events in early April reversed the legacy of the Tulip Revolution in 2005, when Bakiyev rode anger over a fraudulent election to take over the poor landlocked Central Asian nation. More than 80 people were killed and over 1,000 injured as opposition activists faced police who fired on the protesters. President Bakiyev lost support steadily since the 2005 revolution and had recently clamped down on activists and independent journalists. Only weeks before the unrest, the US-based Jamestown Foundation warned of an impending coup in Kyrgyzstan, noting the military had been given new powers to repress the opposition. The foundation also warned that President Bakiyev had lost a power struggle with his brother, who controls most of the country's military and intelligence services. The brother, Zanish Bakiyev, had been implicated in a series of contract killings and beatings of opposition activists and journalists. US officials had sought close ties with Bakiyev to protect its lease for a US airbase in the country, used to supply troops in Afghanistan while overlooking the regime's human rights abuses. Bert Stupak is an 18-year member of Congress from the conservative Upper Peninsula of Michigan. In a last-minute effort to pass the health reform bill, he negotiated with President Obama to sign an executive order reaffirming the Hyde Amendment. The amendment bans the use of federal funds to pay for abortion services. After the passage of the health care reform bill, Stupak faced intense opposition from Tea Party activists and anti-choice groups who were running TV and radio ads in Stupak's Michigan district. Now the Democratic congressman has announced his retirement from Congress. According to the New York Times, Stupak was apparently not prepared for a difficult re-election battle since he had not raised a large amount of campaign contributions for the upcoming midterm election. Among pro-choice activists, there is still a high level of frustration about how the healthcare debate turned out. In the end, the Hyde Amendment became more entrenched in federal law and may impact more working-class women as the deep recession has forced more women to rely on Medicaid for basic health services. Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards told The Nation magazine, "The healthcare law goes far beyond current regulations in placing unreasonable burdens on those who either want to offer or purchase private healthcare coverage for abortion." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.
testimony before Congress in February, President Obama's Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair, made a startling admission. He declared before the House Intelligence Committee that the president reserves the right to have the CIA carry out assassinations against U.S. citizens who are engaged in terrorist activity. He said, "We take direct actions against terrorists in the intelligence community. If we think that direct action will involve killing an American, we get specific permission to do that." Blair went on to say that Americans would not be assassinated overseas for criticizing the government, but are subject to assassination only when the government decides they are a threat. Although his name wasn't mentioned, Blair's statements were presumed to be referring to radical Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen born in New Mexico. Mr. al-Awlaki, now believed to be hiding in Yemen, is said by government officials to be linked to two recent acts of terrorism: the November shooting of 13 people at Fort Hood, Texas, by U.S. Army Major Nadal Malik Hassan, and the attempted bombing of a Detroit-bound airliner by a Nigerian man on Christmas Day. Although President Bush was assailed by civil liberties advocates for designating suspected terrorists, including U.S. citizens, as enemy combatants, imprisoning them without charge, trial, or access to attorneys, there is no evidence that Mr. Bush ever ordered the assassination of an American citizen. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Emily Berman, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, who challenges the right of President Obama to order the assassination of a U.S. citizen without formally charging them with crimes and following minimum standards of due process.
This announcement comes as part of the larger program that you and your listeners may have heard about, the drone predator attacks that have been ongoing, especially in Afghanistan and the Afghanistan-Pakistan border regions. And it's a targeted killing program aimed at taking out members of al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces fighting against the U.S. in Afghanistan, largely. And as you said, this was a somewhat startling pronouncement that, in fact, U.S. citizens could be put on the list to be targeted by this program, and that al-Awlaki was, in fact, one of them. Really, the legal issues involved are relatively complicated and involve international humanitarian law, the law of armed conflict, human rights law, and, of course, domestic constitutional law are all implicated. And any targeted killing like this would have to follow any of those rules that happen to apply. But the most alarming element of this program is how little we really know about it. Unlike most military efforts, these drone programs lend themselves to secrecy. They're essentially invisible to everyone except their victims, human rights monitors, journalists, unable to verify claims about how narrowly they're targeted, what the civilian casualties might be. And so these are all concerns that are raised quite starkly by this latest revelation.
During the presidency of George W. Bush, there was a lot of outrage among civil liberties groups about Mr. Bush's imprisonment of Jose Padilla, who allegedly was planning to carry out a dirty bombing of the United States. He was in prison without charge, trial, or access to attorney for a time. Although President Bush had been accused of abuse of power during his 8 years in office, he never, I guess, according to the record, at least the overt record, had authorized the assassination of a U.S. citizen. But here we have President Obama doing just that. And it seems like it exceeds what many people believe to be the overreach of George Bush in terms of his use of executive power during his presidency.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. As you said, George Bush, of course, did assert the authority to detain U.S. citizens as part of his war on terror, but never, as far as we know, claimed the power to target one for killing. And it's been, you know, quite widely reported that Obama has stepped up the use of these drone attacks significantly over the use that the Bush administration had put them to. It's part of his surge in Afghanistan and efforts in that area. But it does raise some very thorny legal questions. And the one that's particularly troubling in the case of Iwaki is if you say, of course, anyone who takes up arms on the battlefield against U.S. soldiers and points guns at them and throws bombs at them, that person then becomes a legitimate military target. But if you are talking about someone who is living in Yemen, which is far from any active battlefield in the war in Afghanistan, and certainly not imminently threatening U.S. soldiers in the way that someone on a battlefield with a gun would be, then using the justification that we're at war with al-Qaeda and this man is associated with al-Qaeda in some way, it really seems to open up the whole globe to these sorts of targeted attacks, and it really raises the question of what limits are there? Could someone in any country around the world be targeted? Could someone be targeted in America, for example? It's, of course, an extreme case, but the fact that they're asserting the power to do this in a country, a sovereign nation with which we're not at war, against someone who's an American citizen who is not on a battlefield fighting U.S. troops, it really makes you wonder what, if any, limits there are to this power.
Emily Berman, what power does Congress have to turn this around, specifically Obama's declaration that he has the right to assassinate U.S. citizens without going through any formal process? What can Congress do, and what can citizens do who are appalled at this, just as they were appalled at many of the abuses of power under George W. Bush?
Well, Congress has the power to craft, along with the president, policies for how this country is going to use its military and to counter terrorism. It can't necessarily, the president is the commander in chief, so Congress can't necessarily second guess particular battlefield decisions. But it can certainly place constraints on the use of drones. It can decide whether or not it's going to fund this drone program. They're now making more and faster and stronger and smaller drones. And through the defense budget, it certainly has a lot of power over what programs go forward and what don't. And they can place constraints on how the president can use those materials. And, as far as citizens, as with any other issue, members of Congress want to be reelected. And if they find that there's not the support for what they're doing and there's popular support out there for a change of course, that's the thing that always can make the difference. So people should get in touch with their representatives and let them know what they think.
That was Emily Berman, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. Contact the center by calling area code 212-998-6730, or visit their website at brennancenter.org. Environmental justice and green jobs advocate Van Jones founded the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in Oakland, California, in 1996, where he promoted the idea of eliminating poverty and tackling environmental problems by training low-income Americans, especially people of color, to retrofit buildings for energy efficiency and build components for renewable energy generators like wind turbines and solar panels. In 2009, he was hired by the Obama administration as a special advisor for green jobs, enterprise, and innovation at the White House Council on Environmental Quality. But after a smear campaign from right-wing activists, he quit, as he explained it, so as not to distract President Obama from his agenda of health care reform and other critical issues. Van Jones now works as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior policy advisor at Green for All, an anti-poverty environmental organization he founded in 2007. In an address at the Yale Divinity School's Environmental Dislocations Conference, he spoke about confronting the nation's environmental and economic crises with a new kind of thinking. The following is an excerpt from his April 9th talk.
Imagine Boeing-level engineering. A jet engine in the sky that can turn a breeze into raw power. As much steel in one of those things as goes into 26 automobiles. Now, there's something those skilled workers can work on. 8,000 finely machined parts in each one. That's something those skilled workers could do. Somebody's got to put up all those solar panels. Why should the young man or the young woman standing right now somewhere in New Haven on a street corner, or in Watts, or in Newark, New Jersey, with no future, nothing to do? Why can't they be trained to go and put those solar panels up on the rooftops of their grandmother's houses? Why can't they be given the caulking guns and the new windows and the new boilers and trained to retrofit houses so they don't waste so much energy? If you take a house right now, with existing technology, you don't have to wait for some solar ray gun, bizarro, you know, cold fusion, Buck Rogers stuff. Caulking guns, not ray guns, caulking guns, can be used to cut an energy bill by 30 to 40% right now in many, many American homes. We've got 100 million American homes that could be retrofitted in that way. Now, why is that a good thing? If you cut an energy bill by 30%, usually there's a coal-fired power plant somewhere. Huh? Just got the demand cut on it by 30%. You just cut air pollution by 30%. You probably just cut asthma by 30%. And yet you also cut unemployment because you put somebody to work. These are practical solutions to both the economic and the ecological crisis. All the work is not done. And the reason that these practical solutions that would let us beat pollution and poverty at the same time, that would let us stop global warming and the global recession at the same time, and begin to move into a green growth economy — if we got to grow, let's at least have a green growth economy — the reason it's not happening is not because of the workers. It's not because of stupid people in the industrial or agricultural heartland. It's not just because of the food fight and gridlock in Washington, D.C. There is a deeper civilizational crisis going on. And that's why you're so important. That's why your willingness to continue to push and probe and to think through and to rethink and to challenge is so important, because we're in a quandary that a new kind of thinking will be required to get us out of it. Now, from my point of view, I can speak frankly to you that I think that the heart of the cultural and spiritual dimension here — I usually talk about the political and economic dimension — but the heart of the cultural and spiritual dimension here is one word, one concept that has not only taken over our thinking about the earth, but increasingly about each other. And that concept is disposability. Disposability. We deeply believe that we have throwaway resources, throwaway species, ultimately a throwaway planet. And that's horrible. And the environmental community has done a tremendous job of challenging those notions. But sometimes, as environmentalists, we come up short, because we aren't just in a crisis because we believe we have throwaway stuff. We also believe we have throwaway people. Throw away children, throw away neighborhoods, and throw away nations. And it's that deep sense of disposability that is driving us to social, economic, ecological, spiritual death as a species. And until we have a movement that is willing to address the totality of this disposability myth, we'll never have the political power, the economic genius, the moral strength to pull off the transition as a human species. Fundamentally, there's a theological dimension to this idea that disposability is wrong. The simple way to put it is the little kids that wear the t-shirts that say, I know I'm somebody because God didn't make no junk. I know I'm somebody, because God didn't make no junk.
That was environmental justice advocate and Green for All founder Van Jones speaking at an April 9th Yale Divinity School conference. Contact Green for All by calling area code 510-663-6500 or visit their website at greenforall.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. A 3-judge panel on a Washington, D.C. federal appeals court handed down a unanimous ruling on April 6th, which said that the Federal Communications Commission does not have the power to enforce net neutrality, which provides Internet users equal access to all of its content. The case revolved around cable TV giant Comcast's assertion that it had the right to slow down Internet customers' access to a file-sharing service called BitTorrent. Critics say the court decision can be traced back to FCC efforts over recent years to deregulate the nation's communications networks. Their actions under President George W. Bush created a set of rules that prevents the agency from acting to protect consumers and expand access to broadband Internet services. FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski, a strong supporter of net neutrality, has pledged to find the legal authority to protect consumers and said the FCC remained, quote, firmly committed to promoting an open Internet. The court decision is seen by many observers as creating an obstacle for President Obama's campaign promise to boost Americans' access to high-speed Internet. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Craig Aaron, Senior Program Director with the media democracy group Free Press. He explains the importance of this court decision for Internet users and content providers, and the most effective way the FCC can fulfill its commitment to preserve Internet freedom and a level playing field for all of its users.
Well, this is a monumental decision, you know, if it goes unchallenged. You know, essentially the result of the court's decision is that the FCC would be really unable to protect Internet users. It would really put in jeopardy the fundamental issue of net neutrality, which is the principle that really protects the open Internet, make sure that when you go online, you can go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want, and it's not up to your phone or cable company which websites work and which don't. The case in question that actually sparked this decision was originally started because of a complaint filed by Free Press involving Comcast blocking lawful file-sharing applications without secretly blocking. They weren't telling people what they were doing, going in and interfering with Internet traffic. And, you know, perhaps most ominously, you know, this really threatens the ambitious goals of the National Broadband Plan, just unveiled by the FCC, a flawed but important document with the goal of making universal, affordable Internet access a reality in this country if this decision goes unchallenged. You know, it could be a situation where they would be actually unable to carry out this ruling. Now, there is a silver lining here and a couple of important distinctions. One is that, you know, this is really a decision based on some complex legal arguments. The court didn't actually rule that what Comcast was doing was okay or that they should be allowed to block the Internet. What they ruled is that the way the FCC was applying its authority or that its jurisdiction didn't apply here. And sort of the irony of this story is that that's the FCC's own fault because back in starting in 2002 and in a series of decisions that culminated in 2005, the FCC essentially relinquished the authority they had. So they used to regulate the Internet under a certain part of the Communications Act. They changed the way that was done at the urging of the cable companies and later the phone companies and essentially gave away their own authority. So that's really what started this whole mess. As I assume we'll talk about in a second, also perhaps the path away and back out from this really unfortunate decision.
Now, just to put it in layman's terms, and I think maybe you've described it in a way that it was very easily understood. What some of these folks want to do is create a super highway for content providers who could pay and a dirt road for the rest of us. And,
well, that's right. You know, if you think about the information super highway, and, you know, we can all go certain speeds, and if you're controlling how fast you go, that is the user, that's great, and I don't have a problem with that. The problem with what the biggest phone and cable companies are proposing is that they really are proposing to build that divided highway with a fast lane for a few big companies and their own products and services, you know, where if you pay a toll, you can ride, you being a big company, not necessarily an individual. But for everybody else, all of the content that they're not interested in having a piece of or that isn't up for sale like that, you know, they would really be stuck on the cyber equivalent of a winding dirt road.
Craig, what What are the options now for the Federal Communications Commission in Congress to do what they can to ensure that net neutrality will survive this court decision?
Well, they basically have three options. So this was a case Comcast sued the FCC, and so their first option, if they wanted to choose it, would be they could appeal the decision. I think that's somewhat unlikely, partly because it was a particularly blistering decision. The other thing that they could do is they could go to Congress and ask for Congress to pass a law or a bill that would clearly establish their authority to regulate the Internet in the way that they wanted to do in this case. And that is an option, and you know, there's actually going to be a hearing in the Senate on Wednesday. I think we'll hear a lot of talk about that. But the best option for me is the simplest option. And that is for the Federal Communications Commission themselves to go back and say, you know what, the bad decisions that were made by the previous administration during the Bush years that changed the way we regulate the Internet, that changed the rules of the game, that was a mistake. And it clearly created a situation that we never intended. The FCC needs to be able to protect consumers online. And they can actually go back and what is called reclassify broadband under what's known as Title II of the Communications Act, which is for telecommunications services. So that's where the Internet always used to be. It's only been in the last few years that we changed it, and the FCC actually has it in their power to set things right, to reclassify broadband, and begin making rules with much clearer authority. You know, the only real question is here is the political will there to do it. It's sort of the gumption there from the new FCC chairman, you know, after this court decision to really say, okay, well, clearly that was the wrong way to do it. Let's go back and set things straight.
That was Craig Aaron, Senior Program Director with the media democracy group Free Press. Contact Free Press by calling toll-free at 877-888-1533 or visit their website at freepress.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Prue Cullen, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.